Okay, so we finished more or less what the what we had arranged to study in marriage based on what's in the Confession of Faith. We talked about both marriage as it was from the beginning and then marriage after the fall. And the reason why I'm still on it is because there had been some discussions going on between, and I don't think they, because they were more or less public discussions, Brother, the Pickerel family and the Haas family and myself were discussing the views on marriage, because there is a view of that which does not permit marriage, remarriage after divorce, and does not permit divorce at all. And this view is actually held by many within our circles, conservative circles, but it is not the majority, nor is it the view that we take here at church. And so there were some questions around that. And I attempted to answer it briefly last week, and I didn't feel like I did it justice. So the goal today was to kind of retouch on that subject. But as I looked at the subject of marriage and looking at it, I realized, wow, I am certainly not equipped to be able to lay out at this point in time a full in-depth study of all the different perplexities that come when sin enters a marriage situation. It's just difficult. There's a lot of different angles to consider, and the texts that deal with it are likewise perplexing. It's when you look at the commentators, there's not always agreement. In fact, sometimes it feels like rarely there's agreement on how you take very particular things. So that's not the intent today. I want to conclude our study on marriage and divorce. What the intent is, however, is here's my notes, is to realize that sometimes, when even though we are in majority agreement, sometimes there are disagreements within the body, and how should we deal with those things, right? And this is a good example of that. It's not an issue which is particularly mentioned in the historic Baptist Confession of Faith, but it is something actually that is outlined in our church's constitution. And so I wanted to read that just quickly so that we don't lose sight of that. But this is what our church statement of faith says regarding marriage. It says, "We believe that marriage is a sacred institution ordained of God in the time of man's innocence," that's before sin, "and that it is the mutual union of one man and one woman. It is morally binding so long as both shall live, and that therefore it cannot be dissolved by a divorce or a civil tribunal except on the evidence that one party is guilty of adultery or in the case of desertion by an unbelieving spouse. In the case of either situation, the innocent party is free from further matrimonial obligations and justly entitled to marry again. But the guilty party has no such right. We deny the right of marriage to both parties who have been divorced for cause other than adultery or abandonment." So, with that in mind, you can see that the statement of faith at this church is what we've agreed together to operate together is that we would permit remarriage to one who has been the innocent party of adultery and or abandonment. So, but rather than just state that, I want to sort of go through and outline specifically why we take that stance so that the questions aren't left lingering for those who were thinking about it. Providentially, both families that we were discussing this with are not here today, so I guess I get to say whatever I want. No. But let's try to work through this if we can in the last 30 minutes or so that we have. All right, so I have five things that I wanted to say as sort of preliminary issues that help set the table, at least in my mind, of why we think about these things, okay? Sort of preliminary, these are conclusions that come to after studying the scriptures, but they're not things that are easily come to necessarily. There's been debate over them, and it comes by wrestling with the interrelation between different texts and why we say what we say. So just to put a couple resources out there, Divorce by John Murray is one resource that I'm working with. And this is mainly an exegetical work. He just works through the texts of the Bible, the various ways in which they can be interpreted, and lands on particular interpretations. And then the second one, Marriage and Divorce in the Bible. This is by Jay Adams. If you know the name Jay Adams, Brother Tim Pasma is a very, very appreciative of Jay Adams' ministry. And so Brother Tim has highly recommended his work, as many others have found it helpful. But more or less, he takes the exegesis that John Murray lays out and then tries to make it specific to the church context in a helpful way that I hope you'll see. So with those things away, the first thing that I want to say preliminarily about marriage, we've mentioned this before, but it needs reiterating, is that when we think of marriage, I believe we should not be thinking of marriage as a sacrament as they do in the Roman Catholic setting. In this conception of marriage, I'm going to broaden it out, not even to the Roman Catholic, but any view of marriage that makes marriage some kind of metaphysical intertwining of spirits or melding of identities or some kind of indissoluble fusion of souls, where there's something going on where these two are somehow objectively, permanently united with some kind of mysterious thing going on there, I think is less than helpful and less than biblical understanding of marriage. Rather, and the Reformers have always seen, marriage is a covenant between two people, right? It's something quite tangible. When two people agree to this covenant marriage, though that arrangement is instituted by God, the agreement is between these two people to covenant faithfulness. And so in that arrangement, it constitutes various obligations and duties within that arrangement. But the marriage itself should not be thought of as something that is somehow beyond the bounds of this covenant, no matter how permanent and sacred it was intended to be by God. So with that in mind, then the second thing, that idea is marriage as a covenant, not as a sacrament. That's what I'm emphasizing in point one. Point two, then, divorce is, point two will make more sense if I clarify. So marriage, not as a sacrament but as a covenant, nevertheless still instituted by God. Divorce, on the other hand, is not an institution of God, it is an institution of man. Or, to say it another way, it was not from the beginning, right? Divorce came in because of sin. Divorce is always the result of sin, and it is always, if you will, something that in the Bible was suffered or allowed, not something that was commanded and not something that was ordained of God as holy. So in this, the concept of divorce has to do with an actual dissolution or freeing or unbinding or loosing of marital privileges and responsibilities. So another way to think of that is, in divorce, a declaration is made that the promises of marriage are no longer expected, required, or permitted. And that's an important point. In a view that says, no matter what you do in terms of divorce to break this divorce, you are always married in God's eyes, has difficulty in distinguishing between what is morally expected of the two versus what is permissible. Let me illustrate. If a couple decides, I just think we're not compatible, and so they split up for unbiblical grounds. Let's say they're apart for several years. After not finding a suitable spouse, they start talking together, and so they're divorced, but they start talking together, and they decide one evening, you know what? Let's just act like we're married, and they go to the marriage bed and act as if they're married. This would still be sin because they are not married. Even though they are duty-bound to be married and they ought to be reconciled, the context of these duties and privileges is within the marriage covenant. Until that covenant is renewed and set in order, one should not act as if they are married. So divorce is an actual dissolution or freeing of these privileges, responsibilities, and duties. So that's in distinction from this idea of marriage as a theological impossibility. There's those who say when Jesus says, what God has joined together, let not man separate, should more or less be understood as what God has joined together, man cannot separate. But that's not what Jesus says. Jesus says, let not man separate. That means you ought not to separate what God has joined together. Of course, the implicit statement there is that it can be separated. Now, it's sin to do so for things that God has not permitted it. Nevertheless, we ought not to think of it as something that cannot be separated, rather something that should not be separated. Okay, so marriage as a covenant, not a sacrament, divorce as a real dissolution of those privileges, So then the third conclusion from this is, if there were legitimate biblical grounds for divorce, sorry, I'm out of order. Okay, third thing to observe is that in the Old Testament, Moses did allow for divorce. There were legitimate grounds for divorce under Moses. Even Jesus says as much. And within that context, ordinarily, remarriage was permitted if they were performed on legitimate grounds. There are exceptions. If you go to the book of, if you go to the Old Testament law, the Pentateuch, and look at those things, there are exceptions where, after a divorce, regardless of what happens, remarriage is not permitted. But those exceptions more or less prove the underlying expectation that, in all other situations, a legitimate divorce means that there is legitimate grounds to be remarried to someone. But on a few exceptions, that is not permitted. And one of those we'll read and look at in just a sec. But just, it's helpful to realize that even as God gave the commands to Israel of how to work, how to think about divorce, this command was given. God did permit them, at least under the time of Moses, to obtain divorce and to remarry when divorce was pursued for legitimate grounds. Okay, so that's then essentially point four is that I would argue wherever there are legitimate grounds for divorce, there are legitimate grounds for remarriage. The two go together, right? There are texts we can go to where say if the divorce was not legitimate, those two are still bound to be married. That is, they ought to be married. Paul says, to the married I say, we'll look at that also in 1 Corinthians, that if they're married, let them not separate. If they do separate, let them remain unmarried or be reconciled. So if you, a separation or a divorce for unbiblical grounds is not does not give permission to remarry. But if there are biblical grounds for divorce, there are also biblical grounds for remarriage. That's what we're emphasizing. And then the fifth thing that I want to mention just briefly, which is also helpful, as we'll see in a minute, is that marriage is actually kind of peculiar in that it intersects two realms, right? We think of marriage intersecting the sphere of the church and impacting things that happen in the church, but also marriage in terms of civil society, the government having some realm or some jurisdiction over recognizing marriages. Now, of course, that doesn't mean government has any ability to redefine marriage other than what God has said, but it's helpful to realize that this intersects two spheres, which also seems to intersect two, if you will, two covenant arrangements of God. We already talked about how within government, God has given specific specific demands that government would put to punish evil and support human flourishing, but he has not given the government the job of saying who is and is not a Christian. The job of church discipline is the church. And so within the context of church, marriage specifically is meant to image and to design that covenantal union between man and between Christ and his church. The marriage union between man and woman is designed to image Christ and his church. So, if that was confusing, government is responsible for human flourishing, thus duty-bound to uphold marriage, but within the church, we are not only duty-bound for human flourishing, but we are bound to represent Christ and his church in that relationship in marriage. So with those things in mind, I'll just state briefly, we're going to move on to look at some texts and try to illustrate why we hold the view that we do, and I trust that it will be helpful. I'm sorry if it's a little bit dry, but we did want to just lay these things out. Okay, so two views, the permanence view and the other view, which I would call regulated divorce. Divorce is never desired. Divorce always is the result of sin. Nevertheless, divorce in and of itself is not always sinful for both parties. There is an innocent party when it comes to divorce, or at least there's a category for that. Okay, in the permanent view, it would say, and I mentioned this last week, the permanence view says this: there is no legitimate ground for divorce, therefore no legitimate ground for remarriage after divorce. The regulated view would say the Bible gives two legitimate grounds for divorce and therefore remarriage. And those two grounds are for unrepentant fornication or abandonment, unrepentant adultery and abandonment. as I was studying this week and thinking about these two situations, I realized part of the confusion is that the two are emphasizing different things, right? In the permanence view, the real stress is marriage is permanent, and we agree. And in the divorce view, there's a difference between these, don't get me wrong, but in the regulated divorce view, it seems like we emphasize there are legitimate grounds for divorce. And so sometimes they can seem utterly incompatible. But what Jay Adams is really helpful at bringing out is that if you follow through the logic in 1 Corinthians, where Paul is talking about, look, a man has his father's wife, he's to be cast out of the church, or in grounds of separation, it's with an unbeliever, one who is not within the church. And so if you follow how the regulated divorce aspects work, divorce aspect works within the local congregation, it would look something like this. Let's say there's a marriage, then one of the parties is guilty of some sort of divorce. In a church setting, that should be addressed as part of matters of church discipline. There should be correction, restoration. And in those grounds, if there is repentance for the divorce, there is no, again, ground for the divorce. But if it is unrepentant and the person persists in their adultery, continuing, as it were, to be polygamous, then that person ultimately, in the end, would be removed from the assembly of saints, just as Paul has commanded. Put this one out of the church. He is not to be counted as the saints. And then in those grounds, we find that there is legitimate reason for divorce. So if you wanted to reframe these two views, it really, in essence, what is being said is that there, even in the regulated divorce context, there is no legitimate grounds for divorce between believers. Note that. There is still no legitimate grounds for divorce between believers. One more or less has to give up their profession of faith, choosing rather to abandon or to persist in adultery to the point of being removed from the church and giving up their Christian profession before there is legitimate grounds for divorce. And so, actually, you'll see there is more overlap between these two views than maybe is previously thought. Similarly, on the permanence view, you could rephrase it as something like this. Well, as a concession, we will recognize the non-original marriage of people, but we will not remarry a divorced person. In other words, even in the permanence view, because of the situations of sin, they're still left where they have to recognize people as they are married. If someone walks in, they're married, and you find out it's their third marriage, what are they supposed to do? Not even someone in the permanence view would say, oh, you're supposed to break up this remarriage and return to the original husband. There's laws against that in the Old Testament, and it would certainly not be appropriate now. So even in the permanence view, there has to be a concession to realize that even on illegitimate grounds for divorce and remarriage, it still, in practicality, is the breaking of one bond and the rejoining of another. Even if it was sinful, and even if it requires repentance, it doesn't necessarily entail this idea that your current, quote-unquote, marriage is not the real marriage, the original marriage is the real marriage, it doesn't work. So, with those two things in mind, we have half our time left. Let's actually look at some texts in Scripture and draw a couple conclusions. The first one I'm going to go to is Deuteronomy chapter 24. Deuteronomy chapter 24 is an interesting text and helpful because it is probably the text that Jesus is referring to when the Pharisees can ask him about a certificate of divorce, where they say Moses commanded us to give a certificate of divorce. But what's interesting about Deuteronomy is that it's outlining a very particular situation, as we'll read. So Deuteronomy chapter 24, not chapter 4, sorry. Chapter 24, and the first four verses reads like this. When a man takes a wife and marries her, if he then finds no favor in his eyes because he has found some indecency in her, and he writes her a certificate of divorce and puts it in her hand and sends her out of his house, and she departs out of his house, and if she goes and becomes another man's wife, and the latter man hates her and writes her a certificate of divorce, and puts it in her hand, and sends her out of his house, or if that latter man dies, who took her to be his wife, then the former husband who sent her away may not take her again to be his wife after she has been defiled, for she has been defiled, for that is an abomination before the Lord. And you shall not bring sin upon the land that the Lord your God is giving you for an inheritance. Now, again, there's a lot of exegesis we could do about this, but two things I just want to note, okay? One is that we've already noted that there is implicitly in this text, even though it is certainly not commanded and is certainly less than ideal, there is, under the Mosaic economy, under Moses, some precedent for divorce. And what Murray is really helpful at bringing out on this case is that we might want to look at this and say, well, that would only be for grounds of adultery or something like that. But as Murray says, if I can find the passage that I highlighted, here we go. I'm gonna read these conclusions, but essentially, there's a bunch of situations that are already covered in the law of Moses, which would say, look, if she was an adulterer, she's to be stoned. If she's suspected of adultery, there's a process to go through. If she is just a new wife and found to be not a virgin, there's also a process. And if she's guilty, she would be stoned. And if she's not guilty, she's to be treated as innocent. So as we go through all these things, we realize that this chapter in Leviticus, or I'm sorry, in Deuteronomy, is talking about something which is not narrowly confined to just adultery. And the importance of seeing that is that when Jesus comes along and starts talking about this, and he narrows the divorce window all the way down to only sexual immorality within the context of marriage, he's actually upholding a much, much tighter view of marriage than was even taught in the law, and is appealing not only to Moses, but of course to the creation ordinance. So Murray says this. He says, one, these provisions in Deuteronomy cannot apply to a case of proven adultery on the part of the wife because they've already been dealt with. They cannot apply to a case of suspected adultery. It can't apply to the case of a newly wedded wife on the charges of uncleanness. And it cannot apply. He lists five or six other reasons that it can't apply to. And at the end, he concludes that we must see then that this permittance of divorce under Moses was more broad than we might be comfortable with admitting. It's hard to say exactly what it means if he finds some indecency in her, but certainly it was broader than just sexual immorality within the marriage. Okay, and then the second thing that I think that's primarily what I wanted to bring out of Deuteronomy is just that's the background that Jesus is coming to when he comes to Matthew chapter 5. So let's visit Matthew chapter 5 briefly and look at that. Matthew chapter 5. We've already been here a little bit, so I'm not going to spend, again, too much time. If anyone's interested in really digging into all the questions about these texts, I encourage you to do so. And I've already stated there's a couple resources here to help guide in that. Matthew chapter 5 and verses 31 and 32. Notice that we're in the Sermon on the Mount. And one of the things that I think is helpful is to realize that the idea of having, well, how do I want to phrase this? Let's first by saying, when we read this, it says, again, you have heard it said, it was said to those of old, you shall not swear falsely, but shall perform to the Lord what you have sworn. Sorry, I'm on divorce 31. I just went too far. It was said of old, whoever divorces his wife, let him give her a certificate of divorce. But I say to you that everyone who divorces his wife, except on the ground of sexual immorality, makes her commit adultery, and whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery. Now, the objection, or this has in it that exception clause. The exception clause is except on the grounds of sexual immorality. Those who would want to hold to the permanence view would look at this and say, well, when Jesus says sexual immorality, he doesn't use the term for adultery. He uses the term sexual immorality. So that must mean that God is not referring to sexual immorality. He's not referring to adultery. He must be referring to some other case. And so then he says, they would say, he must be referring to the case of immorality within engagement, but not after the marriage is actually formally consummated. So, a couple reasons why I don't agree with that, and I agree that, and I think that Jesus is clearly teaching that it is okay, it is permissible to pursue divorce on grounds of sexual immorality. The first is that we must just realize the context here. Now, last week I made an argument that was a bad argument, and someone called me out on it, and I'm very thankful for that. Right? I made the argument that said, well, Jesus is talking about divorce, which means apparently he's not talking about engagement, because you can't call departure from engagement divorce. Well, someone came up to me and said, well, you're forgetting about the context of Joseph and Mary, where they're not married yet. Joseph puts her away, and the Bible explicitly uses the term divorce. I said, okay, that's very helpful to remember. So I went back, sharpened the pencil. Can you sit down, please, sweetie? And said, okay, what was I trying to say there? Because that was not a good argument, and I shouldn't be making arguments like that. Well, this is essentially that I think what I was intending to mean, or what many people are intending to mean, and it actually took me a little bit for this to click in my head. The exception cannot be limited to engagement, because if disengagement is divorce, then fornication in that situation is also considered adultery. Follow that? If he's saying, if the argument is sexual immorality within the context of just engagement is what he's talking about, well then, if that's called a divorce, then activity within that arrangement is also called adultery. So what you give with one hand, you take away with the other. Either the whole context is talking about a non-marital situation, or it's talking about a marital situation. Even if engagement is found within that marital context, and you can have a divorce from an engagement, then the illicit sexual activity within the engagement is also considered a divorce. And so in the end, you don't end up with any other basis for the exception. It would not be logical to think of Jesus making a comment about a completely irrelevant category or an irrelevant situation when he's talking about a situation that requires divorce between two parties. The second thing is just textually, and this also was helpful in J. Adams brought out, but he's saying that word for sexual immorality, the word for sexual morality or called fornication, we in a modern context tend to think of, well, adultery is between married persons, fornication is between unmarried persons. And so we think in those categories. But that's not actually the way the language is there. In the Bible, the word for fornication is just the broad term for sexual sin. It could be sexual sin between married partners, sexual sin between unmarried partners. And so just using the broad term, we would say, okay, well, what is he talking about? And the context makes it clear. That's the way the word is always used. You know what it's talking about from the context. So you could read this as, except on the grounds of sexual immorality, meaning adultery, then, so the two words are not synonymous, but within the context, sexual immorality clarifies what kind of adultery he's talking about. That is, the kind of adultery that results from sexual sin. So that, with that said, the second thing that we would want to clarify is that within this text, when it says that divorces her for any other reason, that is, if he divorces her for illegitimate grounds, for unbiblical grounds, he makes her commit adultery, and that seems very peculiar to us, right? How is it that the one putting away the wife makes her to commit adultery? And there's a couple options you can take for that. Some take that to mean, well, more or less he adulterizes her, or because in the Greek it's not so clear that it says make her commit adultery, it's just make her an adulteress. So some people take the stance that he's just saying it makes her to be an adulteress or makes her out as one who was unfaithful when you put her away for illegitimate grounds. It's to adulterize her. You could take that. The other way of seeing it, rather, it probably the more likely way that Jesus is saying is that remarriage is said to be adultery because the original two are still obligated to be married in that their divorce was not on legitimate grounds. And this would be consistent with what 1 Corinthians is saying. And so what we're arguing for is that there's a difference between saying that once married, always married in God's eyes, or just saying that even though they're divorced for illegitimate grounds, they're still bound to get back together, right? So in other words, it's like saying if a divorce happens, they are actually divorced, and they should be acting like they're not married, right? They should not be acting as if they are married until the covenant is reinstituted, until they are remarried. But in God's eyes, because that breaking of the marriage was never valid, they are duty-bound to be together. And so in this context, Jesus is saying, if someone goes and marries again when they were never divorced originally on proper grounds, they're committing the sin of sexual or of adultery. And this is the way that the Sermon on the Mount has always gone from here on out. Remember, Jesus said, whoever lusts in his heart after a woman has committed adultery. Now, does he mean that in the very technical sense? No, he means that your heart is the heart of an adulterer, or the one who speaks words against a brother and says rock, right, calls him names, is guilty of murder. Does that mean in the very technical sense he has actually murdered? No, he's saying it's the same heart, it's the same sin of murder when you have called someone a name and hated them in your heart. And I think likewise Jesus is saying, for a woman or a man who is divorced for illegitimate grounds and then goes out and finds another partner and they get married, well, both people, even on the other side of that, are guilty of the same thing. That is, they're taking what doesn't belong to them because the two original were duty-bound in God's eyes to be married, even though they separated and committed sin in it. So maybe that clarifies a few things about that text, I hope. Now that I'm down to 2 minutes, I think really about the only thing I can conclude then is by going to 1 Corinthians chapter 7 and just very briefly reiterate the stance that we take. I don't have time to exegete the chapter, but 1 Corinthians chapter 7, we would read it something like this. Okay, in verse 10, Paul's talking about he's talking into a context where there's persecution. It's likely that what is happening is that there are those who are married, but they're acting like they're not married. They're separating because they think it's holier to be without intercourse. And it's in a context of persecution and also a lot of temple idolatry where there'd be temple prostitution. And so some people are duty-bound to marriage who are acting like they're not, and others who are acting like they're not married should be together, as well as there are those who are betrothed and want to break it off and all these things. So a lot's going on here. Paul says in verse 10, to the married, I give this charge. And he says, not I, but the Lord. Now, we should understand that meaning only. All that Paul is clarifying is saying, look, I have direct revelation from Jesus regarding those who are married. And he's talking to those who are in the church, right? So those who are married, we have direct revelation from Jesus. The wife should not separate from her husband, but if she does, she should remain unmarried, or else be reconciled to her husband, and the husband should not divorce his wife. Notice, if she separates, she should remain unmarried. So whatever separation they're talking about, it results in her being unmarried. Now, within the church, Christ has spoken, they should not be separated. Therefore, she should either remain unmarried or be reconciled. There is no option for her to go and seek another husband in this situation. So this would stand for those within church context. They are to be reconciled, there's to be repentance, and they're to be married again, or they're to remain unmarried. There is no seeking a second marriage. But then he goes on, to the rest I say, I, not the Lord. And all he's saying is, look, I don't have direct revelation from Jesus. Nevertheless, as an apostle, I'm telling you how this principle plays out. And he says, there's mixed marriages now. One is believing, one is unbelieving. And he says, if that if a brother has a wife who is an unbeliever and she consents to live with him, he should not divorce her. So we should be looking as Christians to remain married even if our spouse is not a believer. The impetus is to look for, to eagerly seek to remain married. But then he says, if any woman has a husband, in the same vein, if any woman has a husband who is an unbeliever and she consents to live with him, she should not divorce him. So it's mutual. For the unbelieving husband is made holy because of the wife, and the wife is made holy because of the husband. Otherwise, their children would be unclean, but as it is, they are holy. But if the unbelieving partner separates, let it be so. In such cases, the brother or sister is not enslaved. God has called you to peace. And as J. Adams says here, the point here is really interesting. As God says, he has called you to peace. The idea is, God is not intending for there to be loose ends dangling in marriage. This idea of, well, there's separation, but they're still married, and they're in no ways acting like they're married at all. You know, the unbeliever has gone off, found another woman, has left and everything, but the believer is left in the church, acting like she's still married to him. No, God has called you to peace. The word separate here is the same word for separate up in chapter 10 that resulted in an unmarried status. So here, if the unbeliever has no desire to be married to a believer and separates and leaves her, then Paul says the person who is left, the faithful one to Christ who is left in the church, is not enslaved to the unbeliever. It is not a permanent union to which they are attached forever. And if they are not enslaved, then we would read this as, then there may be grounds for divorce. So, in conclusion, I know I'm up on time. Essentially, the understanding that we have here regarding marriage and divorce is that if there is sin within the marriage, it should be reconciled. There is no reason for Christians to divorce one another. And if there is a gap between married and unmarried, they also are to remain married if at all possible. But in the grounds that a person is willing to give up their entire profession of faith to walk away from Christ and persist in their sin of adultery and separation, then the innocent party is permitted to remarry if God would bring someone acceptable. And as Paul says, but only in the Lord. That is, to seek remarriage in the Lord with a believer. I know that was a dense one, not a very exciting one. Hopefully it was helpful. That will conclude our look at marriage for now. Maybe someday we'll take a more detailed exegetical kind of walk through these texts. But hopefully that resolves some questions as to why we see grounds for remarriage and grounds for divorce in very particular situations. Let's pray. Lord, thank you for your teaching on marriage and divorce. We do thank you for your provision for companionship in marriage, and that though marriage is always the result of sin, nevertheless, you have given provision for the one who would be faithful to you. And so we ask that we would steward these principles well as a body, that we would encourage one another to press on in marriage, to press on in reconciliation, to pursue what is right in marriage, and that we would pursue what is your will in scriptures. Likewise, Father, I pray that any who are not minded in this way and minded to see that marriage is permanent, we understand that this is no sin, certainly in their own life, as they are seeking to pursue the same ends of marriage permanently. And we ask that we would live peacefully and lovingly with them. In your name, amen.